Good morning. This is Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM, located on the beautiful campus of Seton Hall University. And by the way, we are streaming on the net at WSOU.net. I am so pleased to have in our studio today Ken Doctor, the author of Newsonomics, 12 New Trends That Will Shape the News You Get. He is also a vice president analysis and analyst for Outsell. Ken, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You know, Ken, this book, Newsonomics, everyone's reading about newspapers closing down left and right. What prompted you to write this book?
Well, I've been an analyst in the industry for a little more than 5 years now. And, you know, we talk about the 24-hour news cycle. We talk about how fast everything's changing in the news world. And I thought that this is even, you know, as Twitter was just taking off, you know, you can sit there and watch these blurs of Twitter columns go by and writings on Facebook walls, that we really needed to step back and kind of figure out what in fact had happened to the news world and where might it be going. And so the book form, interestingly, in the digital age, which is, you know, by the minute and blog post by blog post, the book form is still a valuable form for kind of stepping back and trying to calmly look at what's going on. And then I tried to do it in a way that would make sense to me and to the readers. So I ended up doing it in terms of 12 laws and basically saying, here are 12 principles going forward as this new news business gets built. And the principle of the book is that we can't know exactly what the news world's going to look like in 2015, but we do know fairly well the building blocks. We know what's going to make up the winners and the losers, and importantly, the kind of journalism we get as readers. And so the principles largely focus on those kinds of building blocks, and that's what I talk about as I've been talking about the book and go around the country just talking and giving presentations in general.
And Ken, before we jump into the 12 new trends, can you share with our audience a little bit about your background and
Sure.
your education and how you became to be a journalist and analyst?
Yeah, it was a wayward route. It's one of those things I don't think you plan for. Yeah, it's so funny because I talked to a fair number of students, and you know, when you're a student and you're in your 20s, you oftentimes expect, you know, if you do the right set of things, you're going to end up in the right place. It's kind of a nice linear direction, and I think for most people it's not. It's a combination of preparing as best you can, then taking opportunities that you can, and oftentimes you go zigzagging along, and I did. And I guess briefly, I worked for Knight Ridder Newspapers for 21 years, and that career followed 7 years in the alternative press. So I got out of journalism school in a master's program at the University of Oregon, and I immediately became editor and publisher of a very small newspaper, an alternative weekly in Eugene, Oregon, in 1975. It turns out that was the best internship I could have. I made very little money, but worked there for 7 years, built the paper, learned how to clean out coin boxes as well as edit investigative pieces and the business of advertising and lots more. And so I was able to do that. Then that kind of set me up, did magazines for a couple of years, and then Knight Ridder for 21 years. And Knight Ridder was never a great brand name, but it was the second biggest newspaper company in the country, Miami Herald, San Jose Mercury News, Detroit Free Press. And I was an editor. I entered as an editor because of my previous experience. I ended up as managing editor of the St. Paul Pioneer Press in the Twin Cities. And then in 98... I went out to San Jose and became vice president of editorial for Knight Ridder New Media. And that was the bright, optimistic time when a newspaper company said, this is exciting stuff. We can create a future. The print business was still holding, so it was the idea of creating the future while we're still making 20% profits. And I worked at Knight Ridder Digital as VP Editorial, then VP Strategy, VP Content Services, which was interesting in syndication, for 7 years overall. And that all led up to what's turned into my next career as a news industry analyst.
Fascinating, fascinating. So when you said it was a zig and a zag, the time at Knight Ridder, that was a long zig.
It was a long leg. It was. I really think of these things as internships.
Yes.
You know? And no matter how old you get, and I think they kind of work for me anyways. They worked in, we've heard of seven-year itches in relationships. My own career has been in kind of seven-year increments. So even though I had 21 years at Knight Ridder, they're kind of broken up into three parts, and editing and management and digital and all that kind of stuff. And so where I ended up, and it wasn't that I prepared myself for it, but I did keep my eyes open and I kept on learning some stuff, which was good, was I've got that background both in print and digital and editorial and business. And so that has set me up well, because the big question right now is what kind of business models and how you going to get money to support journalism.
And you know what, we're going to talk about the subscription versus the free versus the freemium and advertising. But before we jump into that, let's start off with your 12 new trends that you feel that are going to shape the news that we're going to get. The first one is called, in the age of Darwinian content, you are your own editor. What do you mean by that?
Well, the first part, Darwinian content, it used to be when I was the managing editor at the Pioneer Press, and I still remember like that first week when I took over. Managing editor's job is to make sure the paper gets out and it's a good paper. It's number two position in the newsroom. But one thing you do as managing editor is you have the decision power to decide what are going to be the final five or six stories on page one, and in fact, whether a story appears in the paper or not. And so that's the traditional gatekeeper function of an editor. You know, what actually people are going to see or not see, because in St. Paul, you go back to middle 1990s, kind of pre-internet pretty much. If it was in the paper, they read it. If not, they didn't know about it. So that was the traditional, that's been the traditional role of the editor for a long time, to decide basically what's in, what's out, what's prominent, what's not. Now, what's going on is that clearly the internet is a direct one-to-one medium. And so we can all go and pick out what we want to read, and what we have to read is essentially infinite. Unfortunately, we don't have any more hours in our day, and we have much more content we could ever read in any day, even if you stayed up for 24 hours. So the Darwinian content part of it is, this is really, the fittest content, the best content. If you want a movie review, you no longer have to wait for the Friday paper and see what the local critic said. Any time of the day during the week, you can go to the internet and find, 80 reviews, plus the sum-ups on, Rotten Tomatoes and those kind of places. So the content is fighting against each other. And then the second part of it, it's interesting, this principle was the last principle I added to the book, and I ended up making it the first, and I'm glad I did, because in the time since, it's become even more important. So if you look at how do we decide what to read, well, it used to be the editor decided, as I talked about, and now increasingly what we're doing is, we go to some sites on our own, but also, depending on what we get in our email inboxes or what we see on Twitter or what we see on Facebook walls, that's what we decide what we're going to read. We are taking the recommendations of others, and it's basically, some people are kind of calling it a recommender ecosystem, and I think that's one way to describe it, that we are basically saying, if I get a story idea from somebody or a story link, I may read it. I get it from three people, I'm going to read it. Or if I get it from, my boss, I'm most definitely going to read it. So that's what's going on, and we're just starting to measure that. We started measuring that in a last survey we did with Outsell last summer, one of the companies I do work with as an analyst. And we're just starting to see measurement of then how much traffic is coming to news sites from Twitter and Facebook. And it's growing rapidly. It's the number one source of new traffic to websites, although it's not on a par with Google yet.
But, information overload. We are being hit with all this type of information from all this various different social media.
Yeah.
You know, so what is the answer? Is there a semantic application out there that's going to aggregate this stuff for us and organize it so that we can then see a visualization of it so that we can pick and choose what information is most important to us? Or do we still have to deal with this whole thing of really reading through a list of results? What do you think, Ken?
I think the list of results part, kind of, you think of Google News or Yahoo News right now are still pretty much lists of results. Yeah. And I think in terms of aggregation, that's news 1.0 still. You know, it's just, you know, it's headline links arranged with some hierarchy, but not a lot of hierarchy. And, you know, the helpful, you know, the little helpful parenthesis on Google, you know, one of 1,961 stories.
Yeah.
You know, which is exactly to your point, makes you feel like, oh my God, you know, how do I find the right one? I think there are a variety of solutions here, but I think the solutions are better aggregation. And I think better aggregation, you can go to a site like a Yahoo or Google. They're working on next generation. You can go to a Huffington Post, especially if you happen to agree with its viewpoint. It's doing an aggregation of what it thinks is important, which is really the same old gatekeeper function I talked about. I think in terms of technology, I think a lot of it's going to be, essentially technology systems learning what I like and what I read and giving me more of it on a page rather than me personalizing. Personalization, where we actively personalize pages and say this is what I want, simply hasn't caught on. You know, there's a new rank of companies trying it. But I think in general, if you look at you take a page from behavioral targeting, which is pretty much the future of digital advertising, of delivering to us a relevant ad based on what we've read and who we are within a 20th of a second. The same thing I think is true in content, that if you know that someone's been watching, you know, and reading baseball stories and reading about the elections in the UK, and that they, they care about what is going on with the Thai bot, you're going to give them more stories that way. Now, people have the opportunity to go off and search for stuff and go get other stuff, which further informs what they'll get in the future. But I think that's the way it'll work. I think the systems get smarter and show us more things on the topics that we have shown an interest about.
Now, speaking to that, there's a company called Pure 39 as one of a few companies that are doing semantic advertising. Now, if I'm doing particular searches on my computer and I'm getting information that's relevant and important to me, and I'm also comfortable with advertising that's germane to what I'm looking at or thinking about,
yeah,
isn't that going to bring advertising back?
Well, it is moving dramatically to digital from non-digital forms.
Right.
Now, what it does in terms of how much revenue it brings, mm-hmm, and which companies it brings the revenues to, those are the big questions, right?
Right.
So, I mean, look, last year in the U.S., digital advertising was just shy of $23 billion, mm-hmm, and it was just down a little from, you know, because it was a disastrous year economically.
Right.
But still, it did far better than any other form of advertising. The traditional publishers, though, if you look at the newspaper industry only gets about 10 to 12% of digital advertising in the U.S. If you go back to pre-digital and you say, of the whole ad pie in the U.S., what share did newspaper industry got? It got 20%.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at those two numbers and you say, yes, there's going to be an increase in online advertising in overall dollars, although it's an efficient medium, so we don't know how much money is really going to be spent there and how, you know, as it gets switched from print and broadcast to digital. But a compelling fact is that traditional companies, newspaper companies, magazine companies, broadcast companies, are not getting the lion's share of the new advertising, the growth, that's going to non-news companies.
So the pie has grown, but unfortunately the newspapers have been somewhat left behind.
They really have, yeah. I mean, they're taking in this year or last year, taking $3 billion or a little less of online advertising. Newspaper industry, by comparison into that $3 billion they're taking in, is down about $20 billion a year in what they've lost in print advertising over the last 5-6 years. So they've got $3 billion. You know, it's kind of classic. It's like, wow, look at this growth, $3 billion we didn't have before. But $20 billion is gone, and that's largely not coming back. That's the core arithmetic there. That
is that the reason why I think the Wall Street Journal is charging their subscribers. If you want to get the Wall Street Journal online on the iPad, they're actually charging you an extra subscription fee.
Well, all news media, it's dawning on them that I think of it as a New Yorker cartoon. You think of all these New Yorker cartoons over the years where. You know, the corpulent CEO is standing in front of the bulletin board, right? And he's pointing to the not bulletin board, but whiteboard. He's pointing to it, and he said, "Well, you know, this line's going down a little." So that would be the print advertising line. But this other line, it's magically going up, and we think everything's going to be okay. That's essentially what happened in the newspaper industry. Is they said, "Yeah, print's going to mature, digital's going to grow." But one will replace the other, and everything will be okay. And in fact, it couldn't, because they're two completely different systems in terms of how people spend money, in terms of the advertising money. And they had no idea, but they hoped that New Yorker cartoon would come true. So today, what they have realized is there's not going to be near enough money in digital journalism as journalism becomes more digital. There's not going to be as much money in advertising, period. And so the reliance, the wanted reliance on more dollars from readers is what you see that Wall Street Journal push. You see a number of smaller papers now trying metering systems of charging if you're going to read more than 10 or 20 articles a month. But in general, what they would like to do is they'd like to change the formula. The formula for years in the U.S. was 80% of revenues come from advertising, 20% come from readers through circulation. In Europe, it's always been about 65-35, and in Japan, it's actually majority from readers over years. Mm-hmm. But in the U.S., 80-20. So what the Journal, FT, and basically every daily newspaper company, if it could do it, would do is try to get that number closer to 50-50, where readers are paying half the freight for the journalism, whether it's print or whether it's digital.
And the print advertising dollars, where did they go? Did they go off into some other category, some other area, or did they just disappear?
They went to a variety of places. There hasn't been great growth, but there hasn't been great loss of advertising dollars. So first, what you see is that overall, as I said, close to $23 billion in online advertising last year, right? Of that number, so interesting number, right? Let's say 23 to round it off. The newspaper industry is down about 20. Broadcast, I don't recall the number offhand, but it's down, but not down as much. So it's mainly come out of newspapers, number one, and especially newspaper classifieds. It's come out of broadcast, number two, and a small number of dollars relatively have come out of print magazines. Now, that money then has moved into online advertising directly, and then there's one other big factor here which has gotten relatively little attention, and that is if you are, say, Best Buy. Best Buy now is a publisher of all things. So while, yes, they continue their advertising, they'll do their insert in the Sunday paper because it is still economically worthwhile, they have a thriving BestBuy.com site, which many of us probably have visited. They have diverted what is advertising money to some degree to marketing, to building their own sites, and to marketing those sites, building them, all the customer relations there, lots and lots of people working on it. And the number there is truly astounding. This, again, is an outsell survey, not done by me, but done by my colleague, Chuck Richard. In this year, we believe $63 billion will be spent just by U.S. companies on their own websites. $63 billion. And this is up from just $20 billion 3 years ago. So the whole notion of advertising and marketing is changing, and there's a blur. Because Best Buy doesn't want to spend advertising dollars. Best Buy wants to gain customers, retain customers, make more sales. If it can do that through its own website more efficiently and make more money than through advertising, it's going to do it just like any merchant, big or small, is going to do. So that's another place that money has gone, and that is one that a lot of people don't pay attention to.
That is very significant, very significant. So, you know, it's almost like I look at the captains of the newspaper industry were almost at sleep at the wheel, you know, watching this decline. I was at the Wall Street
Journal. Or on the golf course.
The golf course or at a fancy retreat. I mean, I was at the Wall Street Journal from 83 to 96. Yeah. And in 1994, Peter Kahn and I were having a conversation, and he was talking about how well they were doing with the Wall Street Journal online and how the print subscription was holding. Now, the Wall Street Journal, are they just an aberration just because of their franchise is so strong?
Well, yeah, they're an aberration in part, yes, and exactly for that. I mean, if you look at the pay models that have worked, you can put your hand out in front of you and count them on five fingers, unfortunately. It's really the Wall Street Journal and the FT are the most successful, and the FT is, you know, the Wall Street Journal of Britain. Those two papers that have deep proprietary, meaning non-duplicated, right, financial business news information that people use to make decisions about money, about buying, about selling, about many kinds of business decisions, it's an incidental cost. If you're making a lot of decisions about money, you need to know stuff, and then the information's relatively cheap. You look at one of the other few cases of successful paid models, and it's Consumer Reports. And once again, if I'm buying a car or a refrigerator, and I say, well, you know, for $9.95 or $29.95, depending on, you know, how I want to pay for it, that's not a bad deal. You know, I may be able to save myself some money in buying that car. Those are the models that have worked. And we're going to see a number of experiments in terms of the local press this year trying metering models, which is the FT model, which basically says you can't, you know, the FT is now saying you can get 10 free articles a month if you register, and we know who you are, but that's it, and then you got to pay. The journal's model is a little different, but basically the same principle. We'll see whether the local press can get its readers to actually pay. My own sense is the smaller the paper, the more unique the content, the more likely they'll get people to pay. But it's really the metropolitan-sized papers that are in a world of hurt and will continue to be so, and they're the ones that have a harder time charging, because they have a lot more competition, where you or I can get what they're offering largely by free from other media. So if they charge, why will people go to them?
And what do you think about Rupert Murdoch's latest foray with the Wall Street Journal New York Metropolitan edition?
I it's just fascinating. And, you know, having worked in the Twin Cities, it was great. When I was there 11 years overall, I was so lucky because that was a competitive newspaper market. We competed against the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. The big guys, we were the small guys, and it was a huge motivator, and the real beneficiaries were the readers. They got spirited competitive journalism. So from a journalistic point of view, it's great. It's great that the Journal is taking on the Times. From a business point of view, I look at it as just a key part of the overall Murdoch strategy, which is to kill the Times. Now, if he can manage to wound his biggest opponent, which is the Times, both for business and political reasons in his case, it's a good idea. So the New York strategy is really a twofer strategy. He can sell ads to Bloomingdale's that he wasn't getting before and getting some new revenue, although they're discounting them significantly. But if he can take a dollar from Bloomingdale's that's no longer going to the Times, he's not only making a little money, but he's taking the money out of the Times' pockets, which is what he's trying to do. So I think it's less of a battle to win New York than it's just another front in the war against New York Times.
Right, right. And if you're the New York Times, how do you counter that?
Well, the New York Times Metro report is still deeper than the journals, and you counter it among all your loyal readers by being the New York Times, by having the package of content that it has. And it won't see any deep losses, I don't think. But if it sees, 2-4% drop in circulation, that's significant because they're still dependent, the Times is still dependent, as most papers are, on the print revenues. So if their circulation goes down, it's going to hurt in terms of what they can charge for advertising. I think, their report itself, the journalism they do is more solid and more substantial and wider than the journal, so I don't think it's going to do a lot there. What you see is the marketing, I think, of the Times, of reminding readers what they get from the New York Times package.
Well, the New York Times has a wonderful commercial that's been running for the last 2 or 3 years that people talk about their experts in a particular area. And the different time sections, which is it's very good. So it's going to be very interesting. Now you talk about the digital dozen, and is the New York Times still in that digital dozen? I guess if it's Rupert Murdoch, he wouldn't want them in the digital dozen. But tell us about the digital dozen.
it's the whole idea that. Even though we have a lot of new players and the internet makes it possible for anybody to have to essentially be a publisher, and the internet is the new printing press, so the barrier to entry is low, that it is still very good to be a big and especially globally oriented news company. So the digital dozen is a term I came up with for how I see this battle being played out over the next several years. And one interesting part of it is that some of these companies are U.S.-based and some are U.K.-based. It's basically U.S. and U.K. And when we look at the goal there are 900 million people in the world who speak English well enough to read news media. That's a huge goal. And so you're all going toward that goal, and of course the internet distribution is very, very cheap. So we can cross oceans now very easily with digital news information. So the companies I put in category there, include the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, clearly, really Dow Jones, even bigger than the Journal, but also, BBC, Reuters, papers like The Guardian, which has a huge following worldwide, Telegraph, and the Times of London have pretty good followings worldwide. And then you have AP, and you have broadcast networks like ABC, NBC, CBS, and even NPR in there. These are companies, and Bloomberg. I would throw in companies like Bloomberg as well. These are companies that all have hundreds, if not thousands, of journalists working for them. They're mastering multi-platform, so they're understanding whether they started as a newspaper company or a TV company or a cable news company or a radio company. They're all headed the same place. They're journalists who produce products that go out through smartphones. They go out now through iPads and laptops and desktops and print, and they go out through magazines. And the whole idea is to amass lots and lots of great content overall, niche content under it and created through it, and then get it out to as many places as possible with global distribution. And so what I see is these companies increasingly going head-to-head. Each of them brings certain strengths from their legacies, bring certain weaknesses. But by 2015, I think they're going to be very similar companies compared to how we think of, say, New York Times and ABC and AP today. We're going to think of them much more as being similar companies. So I think the legacy roots will show through for a long time, but I think they'll be much more similar companies. And it's really a question of how well they execute, how deep their pockets are in terms of their capital, and what kind of relationships they make with smaller news companies. So there's this basic new ecosystem where, you know, if you're a big company, then you see how you can get smaller companies' content cheaper. And they're all doing that one way or another.
Wow. Ken, you're going to come back with us for next week, correct?
Yes.
Our 30 minutes is up, and this has been very insightful. And Ken Doctor, who is the author of Newsonomics, and he is a vice president analyst with Outsell Incorporated. And his book is 12 New Trends That Will Shape the News.